I've got a bad habit, and that's when I invite people over for supper, I experiment with new recipes, and when I really come up on something that I think is important, but I don't really understand, I commit myself to try and do a presentation on it. And most of what I've talked about thus far this week, I have shared with other audiences in one form or another, but this is the first time I've tried to wrestle with the issue of computers as they affect the way we live with one another, and particularly the way we do theology. And let me make a distinction. There's a lot of stuff out there about using computers in the church, as in church administration and Christian ed and that kind of stuff. And that's valuable, and that's fine. But what I'm more interested in and having us consider a little bit is the way this technology affects the way we understand God, the way we relate to one another, the way we understand our world. To ignore computers in our society is kind of like trying to ignore the 500-pound gorilla in the middle of the den. One can do it, but only with great difficulty and probably at your peril. Having said that, and I thought this would be a topic that would be hot, people would be writing all over the place on. Well, I spent 2 days in the library at Virginia Tech, which is not antagonistic to technology, trying to find references, literature, scholarly work in the field, and decided that I wished I were in the market for a PhD dissertation, because there ain't nothing out there, with the possible exception of this World Wide Web page. A guy named David Lodeholt, University of British Columbia, theologian, and evidently erstwhile computer programmer, has written several essays that try to wrestle with the issue of how computers affect the way we understand God and the way we do theology. So if you are interested in finding one of the little bits of literature that's out there and have access to the web, then this is the place I would suggest that you start. There's some other resources that he puts on there that you can link to along the way. What I want to spend most of the time on this evening is this whole idea of community, because it seems to me that's a thing that we hear a lot about in our culture these days, the search for community, the search for relatedness. We hear a lot about people being alienated in the political scheme. We talk about the angry white male voter that's alienated. You know, so you have a variety of people talking about the search for community in our congregations. You know, everybody wants to have a good, welcoming community. And at the same time, one of the phrases that comes up a lot when you talk with folks who are into computers, and particularly folks into the internet, is the notion of an online community, that something is there that they found. When I first heard that phrase, I was pretty skeptical of it, and I think maybe as we talk some, we may still be skeptical of it. But let me sort of tip my hand and suggest that maybe it's not quite as clear-cut as we are likely to think it is, that maybe something called community is possible via electronic means. Now, before I get to sort of the guts of that, I'm going to do what I call an excursus on other themes. Those of you who have been in several of the other source sessions will recognize some of these areas that I want to very briefly touch on. Justice, creation, humanity, because I think that our concern as Christians with computers clusters in some of the same areas that it does with biotechnology and with some of the other areas that we've discussed. Indeed, all of technology tends to sort of intersect the Christian faith at certain nodes, to use an internet term, that I think carries over. So I want to very quickly make a couple of comments using those themes. One is that we as Christians need to be concerned about computers and the internet and the whole online world from a perspective of justice. The thing that makes computers so incredibly popular in our society is that they are instruments of power and of control. They allow us to project tremendous amounts of power and control far beyond our capability prior to them. And if you've ever worked with one, you know how much faster you can work with data. You know, it used to be that you sit down there and you, with your little scientific calculator, and you do this number. Now you type in a couple of things and whoosh, you get matrices out the wazoo, more than you ever wanted in the world. You know, one person can do incredible amounts of work using this tool. I've already given you an example. I could not find anything on this area. And with a couple of keystrokes, I accessed data that's on a computer in the University of British Columbia. I could just as easily have accessed one in Kenya, Moscow, you name it. So suddenly, if somebody's willing to be online, you have direct access to what feels like an infinite amount of information. Now, that may be a mixed blessing. Remember, we talked about one of the paradoxes of paradise is that we have a lot more knowledge, but no more wisdom. You know, we may not be able to use all that knowledge, but at least it's a sign of the kind of power that's available to us. And then the question becomes, who has all this power? Who's going to use all this power? Who benefits from this incredibly powerful technology? And we've already noted that, as with any technology, the people who have the resources up front tend to be able to use the power, and that there tends to be a stratification that actually gets bigger. We sometimes think of technology as a great leveler, but it invariably tends to be a stratifier, depending, particularly in the early stages when the cost for accessing the technology is higher. Now, another interesting area for me is the area of creation and the idea of, that some people have begun to suggest, is God as the great computer programmer. Now, whenever we talk about God, you know, we are always using approximations. We're always using metaphor, approximations. And the one that we have tended to use in the past have been metaphors that tend to come out of agricultural society. Shepherd, pastor, vineyard keeper. A lot of folks are beginning to wrestle with the idea of what does the traditional understanding of God have to do with the world of computers, and how do we find some connection? Now, you may remember I commented yesterday that one of the functions of the Christian doctrine of creation has always been to talk about the contingency of the created order. That is, that unless God keeps creating, it ceases to exist. It implodes within on itself. That absent God's speaking again and again in perpetuity, there is no created order. Well, have you ever run a computer program? You know, you put that thing in and hit, you know, I don't know, a SimCity, and boop, suddenly there's a world there, you know. Or another area, even more sophisticated, if you've ever put on the helmets and played around with virtual reality, where you're sort of walking through this world and it feels like it's all around you. Well, there's a sense in which, you know, that world is very real. And I mean, we could talk about the world of a spreadsheet, the world of a computer, of a word processing program. It exists. It's real, except it's not. As soon as you turn off the program, it ceases to exist. Well, And some people have begun to play around with the idea that what does that say about the way we exist in the world? You know, it may or may not be significant, but it's an interesting image. And what I find interesting about it is it feels like a way to talk about God that's rooted in our experience, you know, in something very visceral to us. Now, what's interesting to me also about this is that most of the theologians haven't picked up on it, but a lot of the scientists have begun to talk about it, and usually in a negative form. How many people of y'all know Richard Dawkins, the name Richard Dawkins? Guy is an evolutionary biologist, a rabid atheist. He's best known for a book that he wrote called The Blind Watchmaker. If you've ever done much about in the area of proofs of God, one of the classic proofs is if there's a watch, something that has order, therefore there must be a watchmaker. Well, Dawkins' thesis is that there is no order there, that evolution is essentially matter in motion. It just sort of bangs around, and what we got is what we happen to get. But what is interesting is he's written an article called "Is God a Computer Virus?" Is God a computer virus? And his thesis is yes. And okay, you see, a lot of what he does is with the physiological transmission of data, you know, on the cell level. And he says the nature of a computer virus is that it's self-perpetuating and ultimately destructive and incredibly difficult to discern until it's too late. And he says that's basically what the belief in God has become. You know, it got into our neural wiring at some point, and it self-perpetuates without any particularly good reason, and it ultimately brings about the demise of the organism. Provocative stuff. And if you're really interested in it, I would suggest that you pick up this issue of Wired, which is in itself a fascinating experience. It's sort of a dip into the cyberpunk culture, a whole different world, and a fascinating, fascinating world. Let me just show you another article just in passing, if I can find it real quickly, because it's because I thought it was amazing. This is about techno-pagans, the rise of computers relative to the traditional pagan faiths. And so these people, you know, instead of going out into the woods and setting up their circle in the midst of four large trees, go out and set up four 486s running at maximum speed. And, well, it's just an amazing article, just an absolutely amazing article that suggests that maybe computers and religious sensibilities are not necessarily operating opposite one another. Another area that people are concerned about is the whole area of interpretation, and that is, and particularly the concept of the loss of orthodoxy. I may go off the deep end on this one, and if I lose you, just sort of say, ooh. For most of human history, the faith has been carried by the written word, you know, and particularly for us since the Reformation. I shouldn't say since most of human history, since the Reformation. And certainly that faith has been carried in ways that are disseminated to more people through the written word. Well, the nature of a written word is that it needs to be interpreted. It has the image of being objective. This word means something. You know, we see the word book, and somebody has to explain, what does that mean? Well, so the person who was in charge of interpreting that symbol had an awful lot of power. Up to the Reformation, the people with the power were the priests. Dan Erlander was talking about that today, that the power went to the magisterium of the church. They told people, that's what this word means. You don't know what it means, we'll tell you what it means. Part of the impact of the Protestant Reformation was to undermine that And what we have tended to do is to give that power to a cadre of specialized people who do scholarly criticism. We moved it from the church to the academy. And you know, you often hear people talking about scholars say blah, 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 blah. Well, one of the implications of widespread computer technology is that the power moves out of the academic halls basically to anyone who has access to a modem and a connection to the internet. If you've ever worked, you know, with, go ahead.
I'd like to pose a different way of looking at it. I could be the internet. I haven't been on it myself.
Yeah.
I kind of use, in some ways, the opposite of power. It's a bunch of, because it's so diffuse, a bunch of people screaming in an auditorium at the same time.
Right.
So it's like the listener only has, if there's a sole source for information, like a priesthood, if the hierarchy is set up that way, by definition, there is a certain power. Because you've got everybody and his cousin saying 15 different things.
Right.
Maybe address power.
Well, what I guess part of what I'm suggesting is that we've seen a demise in the authority of the church, mm-hmm. first up. So people aren't necessarily listening to what their pastors or scholars are saying. But more importantly, it's a matter of access. You know, there's a certain imputed authority when you're in a certain position, a priest and so forth. You know, they sort of had a chokehold on the authority. Well, anybody with a modem has the access to disseminate a position, you know, and you're right, there are thousands of people out there. But what happens when you go online and you want to find information, say, on God and computers, you get this menu, and you don't know whether the person on the other end is somebody who knows what they're talking about or somebody who is acutely psychotic. There's a tremendous blur there, a blurring of authority, and yet anyone has access to get their opinion out. And some would say this is a great development, because suddenly all the marginalized folks, the folks who haven't been able to make their impact, to get their interpretation out, because the approved channels aren't going to allow it. Augsburg Fortress isn't going to publish their book. But maybe they're right. But, you know, any marginalized group has access to the medium. And so some have begun to ask, how are we going to determine exactly what orthodoxy is? You know, what is the core? What is the center around which we will cluster when everybody has a right to have their voice heard? Now, we're not, you know, and I think I should say people are beginning to wonder. We don't know what the impact is going to be, you know. There's nothing more foolish than the predictions of a futurist 5 years after they've done their thing. You know, so, you know, at this point we're just kind of trying to peer through the glass darkly, but that seems to be one thing that's going on there. It's a subset of the whole issue of pluralism within the society, you know, that we don't have a consensus anymore. Another issue that people are talking about is humanity. You know, what is it? How are we going to decide what it means to be human? There's a quotation that I really like. It says, "We make machines in our image, and they in turn make us in theirs." We make machines in our image, and they in turn make us in theirs. David Bolter, guy used to be at Duke, I'm not sure if he's still there or not, wrote a book called Turing's Man. And Turing was one of the early pioneers in developing computers, hence the title. But Bolter's thesis is this, that every society produces a technology that defines that society. And indeed, they begin to think in terms of that technology. And he says, in the early Middle Ages and through most of the Enlightenment, the defining technology was the clock. You know, for the first time, we knew what time it was. You know, this is a tremendous breakthrough. It brought in the whole idea of cause and effect. There's predictability. We can measure it. incremental segments. So he says, you know, we began to understand ourselves essentially as clocks. You know, we began to understand our world as one humongous clock. And if you go back and read the writings of the early scientists, that's borne out. Bolger's thesis is the defining technology for our society is the computer. That we begin to understand our world in terms of the computer and what the computer can handle. Such that, for example, you know, the nature of a computer is it's either on or off. Yes or no, right, wrong, black, white. You know, don't ask a computer to make a graduated distinction. You know, there are only two ways that switch runs. And so he suggests we begin to think of the world in terms of black and white. That if you can't digitize it, it must not exist. And we say, oh, that's crazy. And yet, how do we talk about things in our normal everyday parlance? We talk about, I need some input, I need some output, I need some time to process that. Yeah, that's cyber talk. And, you know, around our campus, people sort of slip into computer ease all the time so that you don't even know what they're talking about at times. The interesting thing is, for most of scriptural interpretation, we have thought in terms of the man being created in the image of God as things that separate us from the animals. You know, we talked about rationality, the ability to use tools. Perhaps in the future we're going to be thinking, what's going to separate us from machines? That's going to be the great question we're going to be asking. Rationality is no longer going to be thought of as a uniquely human enterprise. You know, people have different opinions as to how quickly we will move to artificial intelligence and to what degree that will be. But there's not a whole lot of doubt that we are going to move to things that look an awful lot like rationality, and that indeed we're going to have computers that are a heck of a lot more rational than most people most of the time. And finally, I want to talk about the issue of idolatry, and I call them the issue of the techno-gnostics. You know, one of the earliest heresies that the church had to deal with was the idea that it's a small cadre that has special knowledge, and in order to be saved, you need to know the special knowledge. Well, yeah, somebody, a church historian once said there's no such thing as a new heresy. We just recycle the old ones. Well, I would suggest to you that computer culture has the potential to become the new Gnosticism, where we lift up the possibility, if you know how to interface with this technology, you have special powers that can indeed bring salvation. I went to a conference not too long ago by a guy it was sponsored by folks who were dealing with the network of Ecunet. And what I was interested in as we sat around the table talking was people began to use religious language to talk about their experience. They said, we're here to celebrate this technology. They talked in disparaging terms of people who hadn't already kind of gotten the faith, gotten online, those poor, benighted souls. One person even went so far as to talk about computer programming as a spiritual discipline. It was an interesting experience to be in that context. I think all that needs to be said at this point is we need to be aware of the potential of looking to computers and online stuff as the new Gnosticism, as the new special material. Well, let's move on to what I said we were going to talk about, and that's community. One of my favorite authors is a guy named Parker Palmer. How many people are familiar with Parker Palmer? Okay. He's a sociologist by training, but most people know him as a Quaker writer in the area of spirituality. Fascinating guy. He wrote a book called The Company of Strangers. And in that book, he makes the argument that the great crisis in our society is the loss of public space. And by that, he doesn't mean governmental stuff. In fact, that's one of the problems, he says, that we tend to think of public space as governmental. He says, on one hand, you've got intimate space within our family, where you can be intimate and be known on a very deep level with certain individuals. On the other hand, you've got folks that you don't have any relationship with at all. But what we need is sort of this common meeting ground, the public square, as he talks about it, where people can come together and they don't demand intimacy of one another, but they're able to be with one another in constructive, positive ways and give and receive certain kinds of support. And for him, public space is really what he means when he talks about community. Well, I started thinking about that. He gives some characteristics of public space, which is, say, of community. And I want to lay them out for you and just sort of pose the implicit question, is it possible to do that online, you know, through the computer? And I'm going to do this real quickly so we can have some time for conversation. He says, one of the things is that on public space, strangers meet on common ground. All right. Well, you know, you go to the park, people who don't know one another can come together. Sometimes, you know, famous corner in Hyde Park in London, somebody could stand up and say whatever they want to. Here's a place for people to meet on common ground, neutral space. Well, you talk with people who are into online communication with friends, and they'll say, that's it. We've got a new public square. You know, I can meet with any other individual in the world in this kind of cyberspace, this electronic world. I can draw near to an awful lot more people than I can physically. Fear of the stranger is faced and dealt with, says Parker Palmer. Well, life, you know, private life doesn't demand that. Or private land life does demand that we deal only with people who are like us or at least are willing to accept us. The nature of the internet, of the electronic communication, is that it draws us out into a world that's radically pluralistic. You know, I have to confront people who may or may not agree with me. And if you've ever gotten into a Usenet group, you quickly discover not everybody is going to. But here's a place where you can meet people in a relatively non-threatening kind of context and exchange ideas, give it your best shot, and receive somebody else's best shot, and you even begin to develop a certain amount of what they call netiquette. You know, there are rules for being online. And, you know, we sometimes talk about flame wars. Have you ever experience being flamed? You say the wrong thing on there and 60 zillion people send you a message back all at one time. You know, there's a certain sanction there. You know, so just like if you get drunk in the park and do inappropriate things, there are sanctions. It's community. It's well defined. Resources are shared and abundance is created in the community, in the public space. Well, I already given you an example. I think it's a pretty scarce resource out there to find information on this topic. And yet I was able to find it relatively quickly. I got something I desperately needed that I could not have gotten from my physical community in Blacksburg. It simply wasn't there in the library. Conflict occurs and is resolved. I've already sort of alluded to flame wars. Another thing, life is given color, texture, drama, and a festive air. Just as a public street gives us space where we can play and celebrate and have experience that broaden us. You know, you go down the street, and maybe there's a mime doing her thing over here, and there's somebody over here speaking, and maybe there's just a sidewalk festival going on in the party there, you know. Well, surfing the net can kind of have that same experience. You tap in here and you get, you know, David Letterman's a full encyclopedia of David Letterman's 10 best reasons for, or the complete Star Trek joke book, you know, or you name it. There's a resource out there that one can access that will allow you to be broadened. You can learn something, you can celebrate, you can exchange. People are drawn out of themselves. Now, here's the one that I want you to think a little bit about. And this is one I think that is kind of paradoxical. We tend to think of computers simply as rather negative. And yet, it's well documented. And I can tell you a bunch of my students who might be considered computer nerds. Face to face, they are terrified of speaking with folks. The more they get on their computer, and one, they become gregarious, and two, they become eloquent, and they expose themselves, they share deep emotional kinds of things. Now, I find that really paradoxical, you know, and I'm not even sure what to call it. I mean, we can talk a little bit about whether that's really community or not. And yet, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, those are the kinds of things that we typically expect from community relationships. It doesn't always work. You know, I wouldn't say that it does, but certainly simply there's the potential there for some good stuff to happen. Let me quickly go through these. Mutual responsibility becomes evident and mutual aid is possible. There are all kinds of stories out there of people who had a real significant problem and they put it online. You know, a guy said, my son is manifesting these symptoms, blah, 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 blah. You know, he's on top of a mountain, kind of like at Holden Village. And I said, I don't know what to do. And doctor gets online and says, maybe it's this and maybe it's that. And boom, a resource that would formerly have been limited to spatial proximity is suddenly available. And in Southwest Virginia, we're already having a pilot program, and it's going to be, I think, done particularly in the rural South, in places where you have chronic shortages of physicians. You know, you set up a couple of sites manned by nurse practitioners, hook up to the doctor, and suddenly you've got the expertise of the neurosurgeon at the University of Virginia Teaching Hospital right there when the miner comes in with a crushed skull. Mutual aid is given and mutual responsibility becomes evident. And here, you know, there's a certain policing, self-policing on the network. There's a wonderful story about a guy, a lawyer, who decided he was going to solicit over the internet for business. A guy in Denver, if I remember correctly. Anybody know this story? There is a possibility. I cannot do it, but there's a way that you basically can post every single list on the internet. And this is what this guy did. He posted to the whole internet list. So anybody who had a modem and was member of any use group got this guy's solicitation. Well, that obviously did not make people real happy. And this guy, not only for doing something, was only foolish for doing that, but he was foolish enough to put his fax number and his email address on this thing. So, this guy got literally millions of email messages and faxes coming in had to change his phone, had to move. They had a little youth group that sprang up to monitor this guy's whereabouts. And every time he would log on with an alias or something, it would be like an alarm that would go out. You know, it's, you know, Red Dog is this guy. And so this guy constantly was getting spammed, which is the lingo, you know. And you can, you know, it's a very descriptive term. You know, just getting globs and globs of spam thrown into your email. Well, mutual responsibility. And that's kind of like people looking out and saying, man, who's throwing trash into Railroad Creek? We got to do something about that. Jerk a knot and whoever's doing it. Well, this guy's throwing trash in the internet, and boy, do they deal with it. Opinions become audible and accountable in a community. And one of the virtues of the net is that opinions can come out now, you know. It's incredibly democratic. Some would argue it's not so much a democracy as an anarchy, which is exactly what your point is. But, you know, we get incredible amount of opinions out there. Maybe you don't want all the opinions and all the stuff that comes over there. And that's an interesting issue, but vision is projected and projects are attempted. You begin to have some ideas that go out there. I think we haven't seen much of this yet. The church is just beginning to get a clue as to how they can use the internet to resource missionaries, for example. You know, it's incredibly expensive to bring people back to their home bases for training, to give them information. Well, you hook them up with a modem, zip straight in there. And finally, people are empowered and protected against power. And this, again, is one of the paradoxical things. One of the concerns that people have about the net is how do we police it? And how do we keep appropriate control? Or more importantly, who is going to control access to all this telecommunications power? Or what is appropriate control? Exactly, you know, depends on what you're more worried about. Whether you're more worried about Big Brother or pornography as to how you pose the question, but they're really flip sides of the same question. But one of the things that has always been important and distinctive about American society is that we have had mediating structures between us and the government, like churches, like schools, civic organizations, centers of power outside of governmental structures. One of the things that's neat about the net is that it allows everyone to have a little piece of the action. You got a modem, you can get your opinion out. You got a modem, you can organize with other folks for a common purpose. When I was in school, you know, the hot thing was to have an underground press there. You know, you had a little slightly subversive publication. You know, that's nothing now. You know, you can post your whole thing to anybody who wants it anywhere in the world. Okay, real quick, and then I want us to talk. Here are the caveats that I would list as we think about computer community. One, it's not going to go away, folks. Computers are here to stay. It's not a passing fad. One doesn't have to be enthusiastic about it, but we at least need to be aware of it. Will online community undermine local community? That's one of the real questions that people are asking. You know, do I cease to have interaction with flesh and blood people because I have an awful lot more in common with this individual in Idaho and this person in Minneapolis and this person in France? You know, will I begin to see my true peers, my true support group as these people all around the world? One of the real issues that we have to deal with is that most of what is online is banal and trivial. Pretty much like the culture out of which it comes, you know. And I think that's important to say. If you don't like what's on the net, don't blame the net. You know, garbage in, garbage out. First thing that you learn when you're dealing with computers. And yet, it's important to realize if you're going to spend 8 hours a day messing with this thing, most of that is going to be garbage that's posted. And so one of the issues is, how do we filter the good stuff? And how do we find ways to do it? Fascinating article in this thing on intellectual property says that in the future, the real power is not going to be the intellectual property, or that's not what's going to be valuable. What's going to be valuable are the services that cull all the debris and tell you where to go for the good stuff. How big can the public square be? You know, a community has to focus around a square, but can the public square be literally the whole world? Is it possible to have a community that's worldwide? Open question, seems to me. We'll all have access to the public space. See, one of the premises of public space is that anybody can go there. That's the nature of a park, right? Whether you've got lots of money or no money, as long as you behave yourself, you can go to the park. Well, we're not sure. Not everybody can go to this particular park, to this community. And that's one of the issues that's yet to be determined. Where I live, in Blacksburg, we're in the middle of an experiment called the Electronic Village. Those of you who are invariant readers of the National Enquirer may have seen the story. We were real ecstatic about that. I think the screamer was something like, "This town's crazy for computers," if I remember correctly. But a partnership of Bell Atlantic, Virginia Tech, who is serving as the server, and local merchants in Blacksburg has made for an effort in which we try to wire everyone in the town together so that it's possible to order your groceries from the local grocery store, and they'll have it there when you pick it up. I can directly access the computer search of the Virginia Tech Library to do research. And one of the real concerns in that experiment was, well, what happens to folks who haven't got modems? And so one of the first things they did was set up 5 computer terminals in the public library. Anybody who wants to be there can access it, you know, for no fee at all. In practice, computer use is usually solitary. You know, we could talk about the potentials for community, but the bottom line is most people go into their room and hack away by themselves for hours. What is that going to mean for community, for family life? What does it mean when you only got one modem and you got 4 people or 5 or 6 or whatever in the family, and you've got this one person kind of huddled over in the corner, not only doing his own or her own thing by himself, but also tying up the telephone so nobody else can even have a conversation with the local folks? And finally, how are we going to define the center of community? In the middle of all this information that's out there, what are we going to decide is the center of our community? A park usually has a statue, and we all sort of look at it and remember, okay, this is sort of the focal point of our life together in this place. What's going to be our center as we look at this world community? What's going to hold it all together? Okay, I think that's probably more than enough. Dan Erlander gave me some insight today. He said, "I've got an outline, so I'll probably be boring." So maybe that helps explain certain things. And I'll be confessional. I grew up as a Baptist and sat through so many meandering sermons that I swore if I didn't have anything to say, I would at least have it in an outline form so that I knew when I got to the end of it. So we're at the end of it, whether I had anything to say or not. And see, I know that, and you know that, because I'm out of overheads. So what are your concerns, reflections? This is an incredibly wide, open topic, and most of the good stuff is yet to be done. Yeah.
One of my concerns is that communication requires a common language. And so if I'm talking to somebody in France who knows English, or if I know French, which I don't, we can communicate. But what if they only know French and I only know English, and I won't be able to get that information?
Yeah. Well, thus far, the lingua franca has been English, you know, and basically because it developed, you know, here in the United States.
Okay, well, so that's good for me as a native English speaker.
Right.
Not good for the rest of the world.
Well, exactly, exactly. That is one of the limitations of it. And but you can't access youth groups that are in other languages.
I can.
Sure you can. If you get on Yahoo, you know, do you know what I'm talking about? Okay, Yahoo is a web search instrument, and you go to France, and some of those youth groups, some of those language groups, will be in French. But the index was in English. Yeah. Somebody had their hand up. Yeah.
I'd like to suggest a way that perhaps the virtual community is perhaps not the same as a physical community. It is true, as you say, I can have a common interest or give information to anybody, put information anywhere. But it seems to me that the internet community is somewhat self-selected. If I meet at the church or in the park, my neighbor across the
right.
hall, the discussion can range over any number of areas as things go. Whereas my sense, ignorant to know, the way the internet or user groups are set up, if I'm a particular user group, the subject in that user group is Indian cooking.
Right.
But talk of his kids or my property tax or whatever it may be, I think that there's less of a impromptu nature to the communication.
Right.
In some ways, the agenda is set by the nature of the group you're interacting
right.
with.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, most youth groups are that way. Let me make one comment, and then
sure.
you can respond, too. I used to be a member of a group called Table Talk, which was part of the Luther Link thing. And it's just what it sounds like. And that was wide open. You could bring anything that you wanted into it. I'm not a member of it anymore because it was like being stuck at a bad cocktail party. You know, it wasn't focused enough for my taste, but your point is very well taken, and one of the complaints that people make is that the nature of online community is that it, in practice, becomes, you know, microscopically focused, you know, that it's left-handed Latvian accordion players, and I'm, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there's not a youth group for that. Go ahead.
Oh, what I was going to say is that a lot of the youth groups start on a topic as you would in any forum or any setting, but then as you start interacting on that topic, a lot of times conversations are taken to email, and individuals continue and warp off into all different kinds of different topics. So in a lot of ways, it would be the same as carrying on a conversation at dinner, for example, here in the dining hall, and then maybe two of you want to continue and you take your coffee and go outside, and then things just kind of warp and twist into whatever direction that they go. So in a lot of ways, it does follow natural human communication patterns.
Okay. I've never been
surprisingly
there,
so. Surprisingly
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
Just a couple of reflections from my own personal opinion. I think one of the things that the internet and this form of communication has is it's missing so many other things that make up communication. Reflection, reaction, body language, feedback. You know, when I carry on a conversation with you or somebody else in the room or publicly, there's a lot of other dynamics that feed that.
Good
the
point.
Humanity of that is missing.
Yeah.
And my experience in a corporate situation where we had email, when they installed an email, it became a collector of a lot of information, which a lot of time was spent deciphering what is important, what is not, and also became an avenue in which demands were generated by someone who would not generate those in a public forum.
Yeah, that is true. And, you know, and there have been efforts to deal with the emotion stuff, you know, with all these little funny emoticons, and, you know, which I find kind of cloying, but you're right, you know, trying to bring that in there. So there is that limitation there. You can't read the person, and certain youth groups will have sort of this opening menu, and it says, you know, avoid so something like avoid humor or something, and certainly irony, because it just doesn't come through when you're writing on there. You know, people take it seriously. You know, like you really must be a big fool, and you mean it as a joke, and people read it and go, and you get flamed.
You can't smile on it.
That's right. Sven, you were.
I have two questions because I don't really know all the jargon.
Yeah.
Do I understand that when you enter this net, that everybody is anonymous? You don't know who you talk to, or you don't know who's reading it?
Well, it depends on the specifics of, you know, a particular use group. But basically, each person is identified, but they may well use an alias. You know, they have to have a name, but it may be, you know, the Mask Avenger or something, and people know that, and they may identify themselves, you know, who I am, because the nature of the net is you post it to anyone who's in that use group, and so you could literally have millions of people reading this stuff. Certain meetings can be limited, you know, to folks who are simply invited to be part of that meeting. For example, I'm part of a group of a meeting called National Campus Ministry Staff, and there are essentially 12 people in this meeting, and we conduct business. The deployed directors and the Chicago staff conduct that. But the traditional use group, yeah, you really don't know who's on the other end. And one of the sort of cliches is nobody knows you're a dog on the computer.
Well, the reason I'm asking this is we've had some lectures earlier this summer about the rise of Nazism and how that developed in Germany. And I was wondering, now is that a kind of safety there that people who are opposed to things like that can really go in and voice their opposition and be safe?
That's a good point. You might want to comment on that, because that is one of the basic issues of the internet. Its strength is its diffuseness, you know, that it's very difficult for anybody to control it. But the problem is that anything can go on there. It's very difficult to control content. You know, I counted it up the other day. Using 15 keystrokes, once I get into Mosaic, I can have a graphic of Miss April on my screen from the Playboy homepage. You know, and that's kind of, you know, I really don't want my small children to be able to access that kind of stuff. You know, and that's real easy, and you can really get into some incredibly grotesque pornography in some of the use groups, and that's a real concern.
I notice now we've all turned our telephones off. I wasn't around here when the telephone was invented, but one of the fastest selling things around were answering machines, because we no longer want to have that kind of communication with each other. We're going to let that little machine do the filtering for us. This will end up in the same way. And it's kind of a neater telephone. You know? It's got more room than the regular telephone, but could end up in the same deal. We don't like talking the phone down anymore. We let the little machine take care of it.
Yeah. The basic, insofar as there is a philosophy, has been, you know, let the marketplace of ideas do its thing. And if these are ideas that are worthy of consideration, that let them stand or fall on their own.
I think Wendell Berry, when he talks about, you know, the unsettling of America or getting back to the values in this country, and he talks about being afraid to know who your neighbor is, Wendell Berry doesn't mean not having logged on the internet with your neighbor and chatting with him. Wendell Berry means, you know, going across the street and looking in your neighbor's eyes. And I don't think Americans are going to give up on that.
I think we already have.
No, I don't think so.
One thing I'm concerned being a health professional is confidentiality on the internet.
Yeah.
As far as insurance and with the new HMOs taking over the medical care and decision making. And I would caution you to talk to your physicians and find out what information they're putting into the computer boxes that can be accessed by anyone.
All right.
This is something that, you know, you really should bring up at forums.
Yeah, that's a big issue. It's
ask your doctor, don't you think?
Yeah, well, ask your doctor, yeah, or whatever HMO you're with. I mean, that's what the HMOs will do, is put your background information.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that again is the paradox of it. On one hand, this person across the country could have instantaneous access to your records if they need it. You know, you're in an accident, boom, they can have it. But in transit,
you know, if you had two blood transfusions, you may never get insurance again.
Yeah, yeah, that's a big issue out there. There's an elderly lady in our town, you know, who is an incredible believer in the net. She says, you know, I was homebound. Folks didn't come by to see me. And now, you know, I have access to all these people. I'm in a Usenet group that's interested in knitting. I've learned some stuff that I've never been able to be taught before. And you see, and I think that's the other side of it. We can be very romantic about face-to-face community, and sometimes it just doesn't happen. You know, there were similar discussions about the telephone when it came in. Oh, well, this is it. The end of face-to-face communication. And yet, you know, there's, for certain persons, the telephone is a lifeline that actually builds community.